מקודשת on air
broadcasting from Philbet on the Jerusalem seam line
put some makeup yeah all right here we go welcome to Apo in the City this is the first episode of Apo in the City and basically the show is about Jerusalem the dynamics of Jerusalem but put it more bluntly where did it all go wrong and how do we come out of this All right. And as my first guest, I have Ben Avrahami. Ben, I don't want to introduce, I don't want to put words in your CV. So you just introduce yourself.
Okay, I have a very flexible CV, honestly. But okay. In this specific context of Jerusalem, I used to work as one of the mayor's advisors for Eastern Jerusalem affairs. I worked with the previous mayor of Jerusalem, with Ner Barkat. And I was quite fortunate to be part of let's say, some historic decisions and programs that were led by him and by the mayorship of Jerusalem in this city, specifically in the eastern part of the city. And nowadays, I'm involved in various programs, projects, initiatives that are concentrated in East Jerusalem, and I have so many friends like you.
All right.
I feel blessed to be here, really.
So you think Jerusalem is like a blessed city, or is it blessed to be in Jerusalem?
It's blessed to be here.
Okay, but you don't consider it a blessed city.
It's too complicated for this discussion. For thing.
No, because you're a Tel Avivian boy, right?
It's true. Even though I'm trying to hide this part of my bio, but
look, when I found out that you're from Tel Aviv, speaking fluent Arabic, working in East Jerusalem, or at least through the municipality in East Jerusalem, coming to this. Let's say this minefield, right? Because Jerusalem is a minefield, especially if you're a fluent Arabic speaker from Tel Aviv, you know, the glitzy.
I see it as a field of roses, actually, not as a minefield.
Really?
Yeah.
You see it as a field of roses. But to me, it was just interesting that I'm like, what is he doing here? Like, how did you end up where you are?
Jerusalem syndrome, probably. But, you know...
But you're not white. Usually Jerusalem's syndrome is by white tourists. You're a shade darker.
And thanks God. probably my origins, my roots, I told you. I'm half Syrian. So, like, yeah. my mother, my grandma, they came from Damascus. And Damascus and Jerusalem are very similar, especially East Jerusalem, you know. In terms of history, in terms of culture, the language, even the food, everything. You know, العادات والتقاليد.
The traditions and the
traditions.
And التقاليد and the habits, I guess, right?
Yeah. So Jerusalem or East Jerusalem is the closest place I can functionally be in comparison to Damascus.
But did your grandparents speak Arabic?
Of course, yes.
Is that where you learned Arabic? Or did you learn it in the army? Come on, Ben, be honest.
The core of my Arabic is from home.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So you would speak it with a Syrian dialect?
I used to speak with a Syrian dialect, but then I became Maqdisi.
Ah, so now you speak it with a Maqdisi dialect.
With a Maqdisi dialect.
But you just said qa.
I say qa.
So ah, that's how...
It's like an... let's say a rural version of being a Maqdisi or something like this. It's like,
okay.
It's not like how they speak in Sheikh Jarrah.
Yeah. No, I see. And were there some things about Jerusalem that you didn't know that you found out when you came in? Like, when you got this job, by the way, did they offer you this job or did you, the job of, you know, the East Jerusalem department?
I started as a junior, actually. I came to Jerusalem for my studies. I studied at the Hebrew University of Jerusalem. My BA and MA are in comparative religion, which is an entire issue we can speak about, my passion for religions from the academic aspect. So I came here, I finished up my BA, and then I was addressed by Dr. David Koren. I guess you know him. We've spoken about him several times. He was the senior advisor to the mayor
right,
of Jerusalem
right.
for Eastern Jerusalem.
With the glasses. He was wearing glasses.
Exactly.
Right? Yeah.
He's a very nice guy.
Is he still there?
He's now working for the Ministry of Education as
right.
an advisor for East Jerusalem. Like, he's in charge of what we call the five-year plan for East Jerusalem, but from the educational point of view. And he recruited me actually as his personal assistant.
Okay.
I started as a student, okay. as a personal assistant for the mayor's advisor. But slowly, slowly, gradually, I became more involved in decision making. And in a certain point, no one can really put the finger, but in a certain point, I became almost equivalent to him. Like, as one of the advisors, I was involved in all the strategic meetings and all the decision making. And I became very close also to the mayor, to Neil Barkat, and to his close staff. And we did very nice things here. But let me tell you that I was very, very relaxed to see that also the current mayor of Jerusalem is following the same, let's say, the same vector, the same vision of investing more and more in East Jerusalem.
But okay, this brings me to a question that I really wanted to ask you, and this is, I guess, where the thing really begins. Our interview, okay? Because you're knowing all of these details about you, okay?
Yeah.
Knowing all of these details about you, I would say you're the best dream and the worst nightmare for a Palestinian. I'll tell you why.
Okay, you should explain.
Because you know them too well, and no, but I'll tell you why. Because best dream being here is an Israeli that speaks our language, Jew, that understands our traditions, that understands our narrative, more or less, that knows us inside out. But the worst nightmare is, with all of that information that he has and all of that knowledge that he has, he works for an institution that we look at suspiciously, okay? We look at a suspect. And to me, it's like, so how do you reconcile that? Like, if they see you that way, if you're seen through this pendulum of good and bad, I'm trying to be blunt here, you know, I'm not trying to sugarcoat it.
Of course,
but they're seeing you as good and bad in the sense that he's here to help us out, but in the end, he's not here to help us out. He's here to fulfill somebody else's agenda. That's how they see it, right? I'm just talking about the perception and all that. And to me, it was, how do you reconcile that?
Historically, it's not a misperception. You know, if you go back to different advisors who worked with previous mayors here in Jerusalem, they all came from very, let's say, mukhabarati background.
Yeah.
From like army intelligence or Shabak or any other organization. And even though they really tried, I'm sure they tried to do their best in order to improve the lives of these Jerusalemites, at the end of the day, they had this aura, this smell of coming from a
security apparatus.
Or, exactly.
Or how the Arabs, an occupational apparatus, right?
Yeah.
Because I don't think they use the security word. In Arabic, they wouldn't say security.
They say mukhabarat.
Mukhabarat.
Yeah, intelligence. They don't say
Yeah, they won't say amn al. Yeah, exactly.
Maybe amn al wiqai.
Exactly.
As you say in Ramallah.
Yeah.
But so, of course, I mean, what you're just saying now is not shocking for me. You're saying something very true. But I think that in the past, let's say, 5-7 years, the paradigm is changing. I mean, look at me. I don't know if people see me as a mukhabarati. So maybe.
But to me, that has always. So the reason why I'm asking this question is because whenever the Palestinian reaction to an Israeli speaking Arabic has always been contradictory, okay? Because they'll say, why don't you speak Arabic? And then the moment that you do speak Arabic, it's like, he speaks Arabic, he must be a mukhabarat.
Yes.
You know, it's like,
yes,
there is no winning. Like, what do you want? But that's how I feel. Like, if you, when you went to, let's say, Beit Hanina or Shahfat, the refugee camp, right? You probably have been to places in East Jerusalem that East Jerusalemite elites probably have not been to. Okay, let's put it that way.
Absolutely.
Do they approach you? What is the first approach? Is it, do they approach you through suspicion first, or do they approach you through curiosity to know, okay, why is he speaking Arabic? Why?
It's always a mixture, of course, of different sentiments. It really depends on the generation you are addressing. I think the older generation, they are more suspicious because they have lived through the two intifadas and they know the Shabak and they know the police, and they are much more delicate when it comes to Israeli speaking Arabic. But I think the younger generation is more open to partners like me or to figures like me. And it's on both sides. I mean, I don't see myself as representing anything, but I think that there are more and more people like me who put aside their, I don't know, army, military service or whatever they did in their 3 years of mandatory service. And they are really focusing on bridging cultures, bridging communities, bridging people. And I'm not the only one who is quite fluent in Arabic and who has this passion for Arabic. And
yeah, but you might be one of the few that's coming from an institutional position, one that they might...
I get your point here. Exactly. Yeah. You're right, but I think that even today you can see more and more people who are from, let's say, from civil society, from NGOs and different organizations, are now entering also the formal institutional world. It's a very slow process, but I can see it in my eyes.
Okay, but I want to ask you something else. And this is, I cannot drop names, okay? I have to protect my sources that I had like years ago. But people that were in the municipality, okay? I'm talking about Israelis that worked in the municipality. Not worked. They were like this council, you know, these councils, you know.
Members of the city hall,
right? And I asked one of them once, I'm like, does the municipality want Palestinians in the end? Like, what is their, the political angle? Okay, what is their political angle? And she was like, look, they don't want them in the end. Like, the municipality doesn't want all of these Palestinians to become Israeli citizens or to be integrated within the Israeli... But this is what she said, right?
I don't agree with her.
But okay, exactly, let's... right? But then it brought me to my phone. I was like, so what's the end game? Like, what is your end game? If what is the municipal end game for 50? Are they 50% of the city?
No, 37.
37?
Yeah.
What is the end game for 37% of the city?
As I told you, I'm not representing here anyone. I
mean, yeah, yeah,
you can,
yeah.
You can ask the mayor. My
position. I guess, yeah. Or fully, even your position.
Let's say my position, my personal position, but also in dialogue with the current mayor and the music, the melody I hear from the mayor's office, I think they are speaking about full integration. Full integration, including one day obtaining full Israeli citizenship.
But do you think... And with your interactions with Palestinians, do you think they want that? Do you not think they still would want to raise a Palestinian flag in Jerusalem, have a Palestinian national identity in Jerusalem? Do you think they're willing to give it up just because of a healthcare?
There is no them, of course. We cannot generalize.
Sure, that. There is no them.
Look, you are, as I talked to you as my friend.
Yeah, yeah.
I think you're representing, in a way, a kind of a cultural elite group.
Of course.
In East Jerusalem, which is very much concerned about Palestinian nationalism, or at least aware of Palestinian nationalism, sure, and Palestinian flag and identity. Yeah. But look at the vast majority of people in your age in East Jerusalem. Are they really aware or concerned as you guys in this aspect? I don't know. I ask you a question.
First of all, I do need to point out to the listener, I'm more concerned about raising the Armenian flag.
Okay, cool.
Rather than any other flag.
We agree here.
Okay, to make that point. But you are right in the sense that I do frequent more circles, so social circles, that because of their privileges, let's say, their socioeconomic privileges.
In comparison to West Bankers.
Yeah, in comparison to West Bank, but also in comparison to Abu Toris or people that live in Al-Sawiyah, right? So my circles are more Beit Hanina, like, you know, we're talking about these neighborhoods, that because of some family money that they probably have, they can afford thinking about ideological issues, right? The concerns that they have about, you know, Palestinian identity and all that, which I understand. And just like I cannot deny an Israeli thinking about his national identity, I cannot deny a Palestinian thinking about his national, even a Turkish person, I cannot deny thinking about his national identity. All right? No, but I have to be fair here, right? Yeah.
Fair and equal.
Yeah, fair and equal. And you are right, at the other end of the stick, or at the other side of the coin, there are vast numbers of Palestinians that are probably not in touch with the political angle of their identity, right? To me, you can actually, I would even sometimes say that many Palestinians probably have a Palestinian identity, a politicized one, that comes from a reaction to an Israeli action. mm-hmm. right? Rather than them reading a Mahmoud Darwish book or, you know, having, you know, I don't know, reading about Hajj al-Amin al-Husseini, which, you know, like, yep. That's what I'm saying. Because if you go to Beit Jala, let's say, right? If you go to Beit Jala, I have a lot of friends in Beit Jala. It's a town that I frequent a lot. It's very possible to go to Beit Jala to sit at a liquor shop in Beit Jala and talk with Beit Jalis and if you talk politics, they're just look at like, what are you like, you know, they wouldn't have any comprehension of a political Palestinian identity. But the moment there's an Israeli soldier or a jeep that comes in and shoots a skunk bomb at the thing, they automatically start to become Palestinian politically, because what did I do? I'm just a liquor shop guy, but hey, you're treating me because of that, right?
So, yeah.
So as I was saying, that I understand when you say that the ideological angle is maybe more limited to the ones that are more socioeconomically better off. But at the same time, even that young Palestinian man that you're saying from, let's say, from Shafat, even the refugee camp that works on Hillel Street at Evo's Burger, let's say, right? That guy, right?
Common situation.
Exactly. Even that guy, although he might not be politicized as a, I don't know, an anti-normalizer that frequents Salah ad-Din's cultural center, you know, all that, mm-hmm. on Salah ad-Din Street.
Yeah.
But I feel like during his life, during his day, he goes through interactions that reinforce some sort of Palestinian political identity, crossing a checkpoint, maybe somebody
entering, or even army entering his
or if his cousin got arrested at night, or that, or even if he's on the tram, like the light rail, right? Maybe the security guard is gonna
a constant friction.
Yeah, there is a constant friction of
friction.
Yeah, exactly. And that's why you were right in saying, I mean, I don't know if you're right, but you were saying that, no, don't you think that all think that way? I'm like, they don't all have to actively think that way. Some of them might passively think that way, you know, or proactively or reactively, you know.
Reactively, maybe in their deep subconscious even.
Sure.
And this subconsciousness sometimes raises out in... as you say, in response...
Herzl was made that way, no?
In response,
the father of Zionism.
Yeah.
Like a reactively became...
A react response to the circumstances. So maybe just to follow your point here, with which I mainly agree, I think what we have to do is to minimize this friction to zero. And of course, it sounds...
million-dollar question.
It sounds like an utopia. But I mean, look at... the reality today. You have specific, let's say, geolocations, maybe Shufat refugee camp, Kufr Aqab in a way, Isawi, that where you have a daily constant friction between the police or security forces and the locals. But let's say in 70% of East Jerusalem, thanks God, you have quite a calm reality, routine. And maybe that's the key for having normal lives here, in terms of, okay, we put aside this daily struggle and focus on going to the Hebrew University and focus on going and getting better jobs in West Jerusalem and learning Hebrew and traveling abroad and having normal lives. This, it sounds like a far and pink vision, but slowly and gradually I see it happening in my eyes. Maybe the best word to describe what I feel as a Jerusalemite, or as someone who is strongly connected to East Jerusalem, is Emil Habibi's mustalah, mutasha'il, the optimist.
Okay.
I guess.
The
optimist.
The optimistic pessimist?
Exactly.
Or the pessimistic
optimist? That's for your interpretation. Okay. But I really love this. You know, Emil Habibi, the famous writer, Israeli-Palestinian writer. He even won Pras Israel, Prize of Israel. And he was really an inspiring author. And he created this mustalah, this word, al-mutasha'il, okay, the optimist. And I think this is the best way to, or the best term to describe our lives here. We are always in this combination of optimism and pessimism, and you know.
But let me speak here now. I'm like, when you're saying that, a part of me is saying, "Wow, if I had a politicized Palestinian friend from Jerusalem, his reaction or his comeback would be, yeah, sure, you would say that because in this." In the way that things are set up right now, in your optimistic structure, the hierarchy, you're at the top and I'm at the bottom. How about you come to the top, to the bottom, and I go to the top, and then I say, "Yeah, sure, let's keep it that way." I mean, that's a to me, and that would sound like a valid argument, or at least a valid comeback. That would be a valid comeback. That, yeah, it's all good, and it's all good when it's you at the top, you know. But how about I get on top once in a while?
But how can this person get to be equal to me?
That's a good question.
Maybe by obtaining an Israeli citizenship.
You know what? To obtain an Israeli citizenship, I don't know if I ever told you this, but my idea, my breakdown of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, whenever somebody asks me, is that Israeli Jews want to be like the Europeans, Israeli-Palestinians want to be like the Israeli Jews, East Jerusalemites want to be like the Israeli-Palestinians, West Bankers want to be like the East Jerusalemites, Gazans want to be like the West Bankers. Nobody wants to be a Gazan, right? And it all has to do with services and accessibility to services, right? Because every time you walk up a ladder, you're closer to that, you know, to be on top of the hierarchy, you know, in this new group, the social class that has more access to, you know, more things and all that. However, there are some Palestinians that can tell you, yeah, sure, we have an Israeli citizenship. Last night, this is a very interesting argument. Last night, I was in Bethlehem, and there was a discussion happening between a guy from, there was a group, two girls from Deir al-Assad and Masjid al-Krum, and the guy was from somewhere next to Abu Ghosh.
Ain Rafa.
I think it was Ain Rafa.
Oh, in Naqouba.
I think it was Rafa. Ain Rafa. And they were talking to a Bajali guy. And they asked, who has it worse, the 48ers? So for those that don't know, the 48ers are the Palestinians with Israeli citizenship, or the West Bankers. Yeah. And then they said, oh no, but if you're an East Jerusalemite without Israeli citizenship, you have it the worst of all. I was like, really?
I'm not sure about that, you know?
That's what, I was too drunk to argue. I said, guys, this is between you handle this. But to me, even the fact that somebody had an Israeli citizenship in this group, in this criteria, did not solve all of their problems. That's what I'm saying. They were still arguing. They were competing of who has it worse, you know?
I totally understand what you're saying. I think that at the end of the day, this is my end game. I think all Jerusalemites have to be Israeli citizens, full citizens of Israel, with full and equal rights in terms of welfare and education and access to hospitals and to medical treatment and all these core rights of human beings here in Jerusalem, and also political rights. And I think that one day you will see, and I'm not sure it's a very far day, you will see Arab Palestinians from East Jerusalem in the city hall of Jerusalem. And maybe even after two or three elections campaigns, you will see deputy mayor coming from East Jerusalem. And I don't feel intimidated by it. I don't feel threatened by it. I think that's the right thing for this city. And of course, I don't answer your deep question about Palestinian flag and, you know, Palestinian identity and final state solution here in Jerusalem. But maybe it's not really relevant, because do you see anything happening in the upcoming future in terms of, I don't know, bringing a final state solution to this entire conflict?
No, I mean, I don't, which is usually why, you know, to me, I always found it funny that people that are against, you know, there's conflict resolution and conflict management. So people usually are against conflict management because they'll say, oh no, that doesn't solve the problem.
Like, but then when you ask them,
what's the solution? They say, well, there is no solution. You're like, okay, dude, so we're stuck with conflict management. If you believe there is no solution, we're stuck with managing the conflict. I personally currently don't see. Look, I'm more or less like you that things are changing. I don't know if they're changing to the worse, to the better, but I also see things changing. But I also know that things can also change like this, like in
you know.
I mean, again, yesterday I was watching a documentary, a Norwegian documentary made in 91, I think, in Bethlehem. Okay, I was sitting with Bethlehem, my friends. You know, they were looking all over, like, you know, oh, I know this guy. He looks ugly now. Oh, this, you know, it was made in 1991, right? And how Bethlehem has completely changed, right? And right now, the wall snakes through the city. And even I used to go to Bethlehem, like, as a kid. Yeah, yeah. I used to remember Hebron Road was, you know, it was an open road.
All the way.
And we're watching the video. And there's this Israeli general, like the commander of Bethlehem, I don't know, whatever. And like, they're walking, they're coming. There is even a video that I've found, an AP video, Associated Press, from 82, I think, where Shimon Peres goes in to Bethlehem to celebrate the Christmas, I don't know, to like congratulate the Christian Palestinians for their Christmas. And the mayor of Bethlehem, you know, he greets him, he handshakes him. And Shimon Peres even says, we need to take care of our citizens. Now, I don't know who he meant by citizens there in Bethlehem. Really? Yeah, but he uses the word in English.
He says citizens. Interesting.
But to me, it's like, well, look at where we are now. Everything changed. Like, if you were probably there at that time, you'd be like, oh, nothing's going to change. Until things do change, right? Because we live so much in the present, we forget the aerial view of things, you know, the evolutionary scale of things, that things can really change. And things did change. To me right now, yes, I go to Sira Bar here in Jerusalem. Some table are speaking Hebrew, some are speaking Arabic, some are speaking English. But can I take it for granted that this is going to stay this way? Can I say, oh yeah, this is a sign that things are getting better? I don't, because, again, I know in some towns or in some neighborhoods around us, things are not as rosy or as, you know.
You mean outside of Jerusalem?
Or? I mean, like in the peripheries of it, like in Isawiya or in Shafa. I'm like, yeah, things are not that good there. So how can I say, just because my bar here, my small spot
like a bubble
of intoxication, yeah, is a bubble compared to the rest of Jerusalem? And I don't know if things are getting better for them because they might say, okay, let's, because even if I'm not mistaken, even in 2015 when there were the knife attacks that were happening in Jerusalem, I think they even, like, three of the kids that did it were from Shafat refugee camp, I think, with Israeli citizenship. I remember at least two of them had Israeli citizenship. So to me, it was like, oh, even with that, look, like, even when they got the document to step up the ladder, things didn't work out for them. Why? You know
why residents of Shafat camp, they are those who are asking for more Israeli citizenship than other neighborhoods? You can ask Hagit from the Ministry of Interior Affairs. Yeah. She has the statistics, and she told me once that they are like the first place in requests, in applications, in citizenship applications. And I asked her why, and then she gave me a very honest answer, that they don't want to lose their status in Israel, their legal status in Israel, because there is always a big question mark above Shuafat refugee camp. Yeah. Will it be forever under Israel, or maybe it will be handed out to the Palestinian Authority, or they will have some sort of a local authority? So since there is this question mark, they want to preserve their place in Jerusalem. They want to preserve their rights in Israel, actually. And therefore, they're asking for more and more Israeli citizenship in Shuafat camp, which means that at the end of the day, people want to stay here. Even in a very, very tough and challenging place like Shuafat camp. And maybe we should take off this question mark, not only above Shuafat camp, but above entire area of East Jerusalem. Like, be very clear to these Jerusalemites and say, as long as it depends on us as Israelis or as the Israeli authorities, the Israeli establishment, we are here to stay and you are here to stay and you're welcome to stay here and you are part of the city and we want to be inclusive as much, we want this city to be inclusive as much as possible. And if I were Minister of Interior Affairs, I would give Israeli citizenship very easily to East Jerusalemites and say to them, come and be part of this common life or common destiny. And maybe one day something will happen in the, bilateral aspect between Israel and the Palestinian Authority, or some geopolitical dramatic and historic change will take place. And then we will sit and see. But no one is going to lose his or her Israeli citizenship, because citizenship is something that I see as holy. I mean, you know,
it's really?
From my point of view, yes. I think it's an expression of being, of having a home,
but
having your place.
But at the same time, if I'm not mistaken, the statistics also show that the Minister of Interior is not approving a lot of the citizenship applications. Even when the Palestinians, even those Palestinians are making that extra mile, right? Are going that extra mile, which in their community might be considered treason, right? And they're
no longer today.
I would agree with you that no longer as much as it was 10 years ago.
Yes.
But when they are taking that step, Israel is...
It's not handing its hand.
Yeah, right? And they could be like, well, you see... Like this, even when we try this, it's not going anywhere.
This is my criticism over the Israeli government. I feel very free to talk to you, and I think this is something that, if you ask me, no one really thought about it thoroughly, strategically. There is no strategy in this aspect.
Is there a strategy now, or is there still no strategy?
No, in terms of how to encourage or disencourage applications. Mm. Of Israeli citizenship, I think no one really sat down and thought about it in terms of, you know, prime minister or the government of Israel. And I think it's about time for them to sit down and take a decision, a strategic decision to encourage it and to help and to facilitate the applications.
But the thing is,
make it easy. And something, by the way, has changed in the past month. Maybe you're aware of it. Now, if you were born after a certain year, don't take me in the word, but you can check it afterwards. The regulations are now slightly changed, mainly for young people who want to apply for Israeli citizenship. They can do it much faster. Let's say people in the age of 18 to 25 or something. We can check it afterwards.
There's something like that.
Yeah.
Because I've always been asking, because... Right, even if you give them all citizenship, right? Like,
yeah.
Let's say
they
agree. Or you're saying it's not a strategy yet, right? Because that's what you're saying. It's not a strategy yet. Do you think it would be a strategy if the Palestinians start to vote? Because then they become a political bloc? Yeah. Is that how they become recognized as a political force to reckon with if they start to vote? Is that...
I think the problem of Palestinians in Jerusalem is that they don't have... a very effective leadership that unites them as a whole, as one big community. Maybe the last one was Faisal Husseini.
Yeah.
And after he passed away, I think Palestinians here, they are quite orphan in their political life.
Does that make them easier to integrate within Israeli society?
Maybe in a way, but if there was...
So like them being orphan works for your... the end game that you sort of have.
Look, if you want to get into details, I think that one aspect is that, yes, Palestinians here should be much more integrated, also politically, also being part of the city hall, etc., etc. But I also think from, let's say, a Palestinian point of view or a sympathetic point of view for the Palestinians, that I wish they could have some kind of effective leadership, local leadership that really can unify East Jerusalemites under one agenda of, you know.
But how are you so sure that agenda would fall in line with, or would be beneficial to to like, what if a leader comes up and he says, a charismatic, effective leader that says, guys, stop applying for an Israeli citizenship. That's not the way. The way is to retain our residency, but vote. And that way, we sort of play the balance. You know, like, we keep the balance, we pay. What if that guy, and he's a very effective negotiator, very effective politician, to the point that it might increase the paranoia of Israelis vis-a-vis the political class of Israelis vis-a-vis East Jerusalem's future, right? I mean, you're right, because I don't, what did Faisal Husseini's vision, what was Faisal Husseini's vision for East Jerusalem? I don't think it was integration within Israel.
It was one city to two capitals. Two municipalities, if I'm not mistaken. In his last days, that was his
vision. But who does the city belong to?
You have no borders within the city. Maybe we can try to elaborate this solution or this vision with one united city with no borders, no checkpoints. But you do have a municipality for West Jerusalem, an Israeli municipality, and a Palestinian municipality for East Jerusalem, and maybe like one top municipality that somehow, you know, integrates and synchronizes between the two entities. Maybe. It's a very nice theoretic game.
But that wouldn't sell in the Israeli market. Would it sell in the Israeli market?
It could have succeeded, let's say, 20 or 20 something years ago.
With Teddy Kollek?
And before the Intifada. The Intifada, the second Intifada, Al-Aqsa Intifada, is still a bleeding trauma for Israeli Jews.
Yeah.
And that's why I'm not sure today you will find in the current political climate in Israel or in the Jerusalem climate some leader who will be willing to go like that long way towards such a creative solution, such a creative vision. Of sharing your
sharing piece of cake,
sharing the cake, yes, sharing the cake, sharing your sovereignty. You know, we tend to speak a lot about sovereignty, about having an Israeli sovereignty over the Holy Basin and over the entire parts of Jerusalem, because of religious and ideological reasons, but also because of existential reasons, like security wise, that we still deep in the hearts of many Israelis, there is this trauma or this sense of being threatened by another intifada or another violent uprising. It's something that we also have to take into consideration.
But then that goes back to what I was saying, that you don't know when things will actually change until they do change, right? Because if that trauma is still there, then it's subconsciously there's subconscious in you that's saying, yo, Ben, you might say things might stay the same, but they might not. You know?
And you can never, I mean, it's really a very complicated theoretic game in which you have so many different factors. Like we didn't really speak about Al-Aqsa, which is probably the heart of this entire reality, this entire
conversation. This is what happens when there's a Jew and a Christian talking.
Yeah, exactly. but who knows, like things, some very bad things can happen there.
Do you mean by Jewish terrorist or Arab terrorist?
I don't know. And both. One can never know.
As far as I know, it was an Australian guy that burned it the last time, right?
50 years ago or something. Yeah. It was an Australian guy, you're right. I think he was Christian. But anyway, one can never know if something very bad happens in Al-Aqsa Mosque, in Haram al-Sharif. It might change the entire atmosphere here and take us into escalation. Like we are standing on a very
fragile ground.
Yeah, that's the right
word. Yeah, that's the right. No, because I've always been saying it, that some people asked me, what is the role of arts and culture in Jerusalem? And I don't know, look, the political visions have failed for Jerusalem. Mm-hmm. At least for me, like I don't see a consensus behind a political vision. Right.
Yeah,
there isn't consensus.
I agree.
I said, so they all failed, which means right now arts and culture sort of take a more forefront, like a more, you know, position at the front to sort of build the ground that whenever there is a diplomatic horizon, mm-hmm. the people will make the same choice.
Interesting.
I don't say the right choice, the wrong same. Choice. The same choice.
Both Jews and Arabs.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. People of Jerusalem. I also include the 20 Armenians that live here, right? Those that will make, because there will be a junction soon enough, one day. And then you, because look, I don't know if things can go on this, the way they are. As long as people are feeling disenfranchised, mm-hmm. you're always going to have a problem. I'll talk as an Armenian, right? So we have a small Armenia. Most of our historical lands are in northeastern Turkey, mm-hmm. where right now I think there are 14 million Kurds.
Right? Kurds.
Kurds and Turks. And, you know, it's like a patchwork of people that are not Armenian. Okay? Patchwork of people that are not Armenian. And I've always told, like, Armenians who are, I'm not going to say overly nationalistic, but, like, fantastically nationalistic. They're like, we'll get those lands back. I'm like, even if Turkey falls, even if it collapses, and you get a hold of those lands, what are you going to do with 40 million Kurds? They're like, we're all over them. I said, then you just opened up another front for a war. You know, as long as people are disenfranchised, we have a problem. Because, look, and I'll talk to you, not as a Palestinian, but I'll talk to you as an East Jerusalemite, a Goy East Jerusalemite, so a Gentile East Jerusalemite. No, but there's something that we sometimes, me and my Goy East Jerusalemite friends, including Palestinians, Greeks, and mm-hmm, all that, mm-hmm. whenever we're with our Israeli friends from Jerusalem, they're talking about, they'll have an application for, like, the cheapest flights somewhere out there. Or they'll be talking about, I don't know, like, environmental stuff or things like that. To us, like, we turn around, we're like, wow, their world must be so lightweight. You know, their world must be so lightweight. Because although I can say, sure, I haven't gone through the tragedies of kids in Aysawiya, Shahfat refugee camp. I haven't. So I cannot even imagine what they've been through, right? But because I grew up in Jerusalem, and Jerusalem was a tent city, it still is a tent city, but, you know, when you grow up, you sort of maneuver, right? But when you're a kid, you were learning how to maneuver. And because I didn't speak Hebrew, so I was automatically an Arab. Maybe because I wasn't also Jewish, also I was automatically Arab. I was an East Jerusalemite on my document. And we were programmed, or we got brainwashed subconsciously to believe that the police are always out for us, even when we've done nothing wrong. Mm. But if we pass by the police on the street,
looking for you,
we are going to get stopped. Although, again, I'm not the darkest guy in the world, like, you know.
I'm darker.
You're darker than me. But it was just programmed in us. Even if you were a Palestinian, blonde hair, blue-eyed,
yeah,
a Neshashibi, I guess, you were just programmed to believe that the police are going to stop you. Until sometimes they didn't, and you were like, okay, that was a miracle. I guess miracles still do happen in Jerusalem, right? And then when I lived in Budapest for 2 years. This is like years later, right? And I was just passed by the police, but in my mind, there was always, they're going to stop me. They didn't give a shit about me. But because, now I don't want to call it trauma, because I'm not into the victimization game. But
have you ever stopped by a policeman here in Jerusalem? Or it's just like
the
notion?
It was just a notion. Maybe once or twice. But I also crossed checkpoints, right? Mm. Which Israeli Jewish kids didn't do.
Yes,
you know?
You're right.
But I do get stopped by police, but not because of my identity, because they think I have drugs on me. But that's a whole different. That's a whole different.
For good reasons.
They stop me because I look too much of an Israeli hipster from Tel Aviv. That's why they stop me now. But when we traveled abroad, and I was talking to other friends from East Jerusalem, they were like, "Yeah, man, we also have this thing that." When we're passing by European police officers that are very chill, right? They don't really look around them. We're like, we must have done something wrong because they're going to stop us right now, mm-hmm. because it was still there. You're like, no matter how many Israeli passports you give out, you're like, that is already stuck in the minds of people, right? Totally. Like, it's still there. And And I was like, how do you overcome that? You know. But again, I don't want to play a victimization game.
No, it's
because
fine.
Because at the same time, it has built defense mechanisms that work outside when you go abroad.
Yeah.
And I don't know, there's like a terrorist red alert threat in Belgium or in Hungary. You know exactly what to do and when to do it because, dude, I've been through this. We were taught by the best. You know?
We are well trained.
We were well trained.
But you know what's the answer for it? Have more Arab policemen. Try to recruit policemen from East Jerusalem. And we used to have, look back in the, let's say, early 70s and late 70s, I checked it. Historically, you had also policemen, Arab policemen from
so why did
from
they
Jerusalem.
Stop?
Intifadas.
The intifada, first one?
I think it began with the first intifada and then the second intifada. Of course, it was a big change. But maybe now there is a willingness and an opportunity to recruit East Jerusalemites to the local police department of
you
Jerusalem.
Know, you know who wouldn't trust an Arab man with power? Arabs.
Arabs, yeah, I know.
Arabs wouldn't trust Arab men.
I know
with
what
power.
You're talking about.
They were
I
like, sure, what, are you crazy? They'll beat us.
Don't give them guns, as the right-wing politicians used to say. But and I will also give a very good word to the new head of the police department in Jerusalem. I don't know, we have a new... like Mefaked Machoz, like head of Jerusalem district in the police. His name is Doron Turjman.
Okay. Turjman.
Turjman. Yes, he speaks Arabic.
Is he Arab?
Doron. Like Doron. He's Israeli. Doron. I think he's from Moroccan origins.
Okay.
And I really love this guy because he knows to respect Arabs. That's the basic...
But it's not him that's on the street with the bikes.
But I believe that his, let's say, his vision or his point of view, the dynamics that he's going to bring to the police department here in Jerusalem, you will see a change. You will see a change, and I know they will try to recruit more Arabs to the police here in Jerusalem. It's not answering all our problems. It's not the solution for all our problems, but I think, and it goes also to the municipality, police, municipality, legal system, educational system. As long as we have more and more East Jerusalemites playing significant roles in these systems, in these mechanisms, I think things will change in a very positive way.
So last question.
Please.
Just so we top it off. So you think there is some hope in this mud game?
As I said, I'm... Mutashael.
All right.
Yes, but I think the optimism is my main
driving force,
drive and sentiment. Absolutely. Otherwise, I couldn't do what I do here. So I know it sounds very.
But do you know what's funny? I've always said whenever it comes to this, you know, whenever they talk about Jews from the Middle East, they're usually talking about the Moroccans, like you know, if you're from North Africa, and then they're talking about the Gulf, like the Yemenis and all that, right?
Yeah,
they usually forget about Jews from Bilad al-Sham, Syria, like the Levantines.
The Levantines. I am a
right?
Levantine.
You're a Levantine. I've always told people that I think the best, I think we should get more Levantine Jewish voices within this place because one side of the problem, no, I mean, one party here are the Levantines, which are the Palestinians, right?
Yes.
they're Levantines. The other ones, you're saying one is from Morocco, another one is from the Gulf, another one's from Poland. Dude, we're forgetting the other Levantines here that probably, they even share, like I know some Levantine Jewish Jerusalemites, okay? They're also from Damascus and from Aleppo and all that. They have Arabic names. You cannot tell that they're Jewish. Like if I met them on the street, I'd be like, Christian Arab. Mm. Christian Arab. No way these guys are, and they even speak Arabic.
Sure.
These people even speak Arabic. And to me, it's like, wow, where do you fall into this, like the mosaic, the kaleidoscope? Nobody even asks you where you are. Like, nobody even cares about you people. There isn't even a book I've come across about Levantine Jews. There isn't. Right. There isn't one book I come across, Levantine Jews. This should be discussion sometime in the future.
Maybe like having a Levantine identity or Levantine common vision.
Like, yeah, I think that helps.
Yeah,
because for all of us, because even the Palestinian cultural scene is going more into the Shami Levantine scene, because they're saying, "Oh, we're connected to Lebanon, we're connected to Syria because of Levant and all Elephant. That." And I think, wow, like where is that Jewish Levantine community that played a big role in?
Have
all
you
this?
Ever heard of Jacqueline Kahanov?
No, you have to teach
me. So I will teach you. Maybe next time we can do an entire episode about her, because she was a Jew from Egypt. She was born and raised in Egypt. She was fluent in so many different languages, Arabic, English, French, and others. And she came to Israel. She made Aliyah, I think, in the 70s. And she was the first intellectual. She was a real intellectual. She wrote some novels and also intellectual stuff. And she was the first intellectual in Israel to put this word Levantine on the on the table. No one.
What is it in Hebrew?
Levant, ha-Levant.
What is Levantine in Hebrew?
So Levantini. And she said ani Levantinit. This is my identity. Above all, ani Levantinit. But the Arabs here are also Levantinim.
Yeah, exactly.
And Muslims and Christians and all the others. So there is something in this term we should try to...
It's an untapped share. Thing. It's
yeah,
an
let's,
untapped,
let's
it's not tapped.
Have another discussion about it next time.
Ben, thank you for being here.
Thank you for hosting me.
Thank you for listening to our dardashe, like talking and all that.
One of my favorite words in Arabic is dardashe.
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 That means talking, talking and talking. Chit-chatting. Yalla, see you people soon. Cheers.
Ya'tik al-afi.